This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Young people across the world are refusing to be ignored. They are a generation determined to build something better, bolder, and new. In conjunction with Universal Children's Day, which was just last Tuesday, I speak now to two young activists in their own right, Ain Fatin Mastulayan and Veshalini Naidu, who are working to make a difference in their own ways. Welcome, ladies. How are you today?
Good.
Now let's get to know you both a little bit better. Ayan, I know you you are Orang Asal. You're from your mother is Semak Beri, is that correct?
Yeah.
And your father is from the Jakun tribe?
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about that, you know, growing up as an Orang Asli kid here in Malaysia.
Quite fun. Because we not really go to the cities. We just stay inside the village. Sometimes we're going to the jungle, find something interested or we find a food or like a traditional medicine like this.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, school holiday, I will going back to my village and then I will follow my grandmothers. We going up the hills and then go down and then cross the sea, the river. Yeah, she's just like this.
Okay, so it's very, very communal, very family-based, very close. You guys are very close-knit?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. And, I mean, growing up, you were frequently joining programs by the Jaringan Orang Asal Semalaysia, right? JOAS. And also Jaringan Kampung Orang Asli Semenanjung Malaysia. I mean, tell me a little bit about some of the programs that you were involved with.
First time I'm joining the program, it's a training about our communities, our right. It's 2014 or 2013, like this.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm joining JOAS Malaysia. They teach us a lot about our right, they also teach us if someone go inside your village and they want to take your right, what should you do? Yeah, it's just like this. Yeah, but I'm not just joining JOAS or JCOSM. I also joining a UNICEF before.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a photographer's workshop.
Okay. So different projects under UNICEF.
Yeah, different project.
Okay. And is that something that a lot of you and the kids from the village did, or?
No.
Just a few of you?
Just me.
Just you? Okay.
Yeah.
What made you want to join these different programs?
Oh, because I like to know more about the others, and I also want to learn about others' culture. Yeah, I know about my culture, but I still want to know what others' culture, like Indian, Malay, Chinese.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's slightly different for those of us who grew up in the city because we are just exposed to it all the time, right? So, yeah, these are the things we take for granted. We probably don't know much or enough about the Orang Asli communities, conversely, right? Okay. I want to talk to you a little bit later about, you know, the kind of struggles that you guys had to go to. But let's talk to Vesha for a little while. Vesha, tell me about yourself. You're an illustrator, spoken word poet, actress. Very involved in theatre. Tell me a little bit about that.
I was very privileged, very fortunate to have the opportunity to be exposed to the arts very early. Mm-hmm. My mom's side of the family, they're very musically inclined.
Right.
And so when we were very young, she used to push us to do a lot of things. You know, first it was debate, it was public speaking, and then as well as theatre. She loved theatre. Among my sisters, I clung on to it a bit more compared to the rest. So,
sure.
Yeah, and so I kind of, I did study illustration for video game design for 2 years in the One Academy before I left and pursued theatre full time.
Yeah. Okay, so you're a full time theatre practitioner now.
Yeah.
Okay, how's that going?
It's great. Yeah, it's great.
Tell me a little bit about I know you made your directorial debut with Skin and Flowers, Intender. Is that what it was called?
Yes, Intender.
Tell me a bit about that.
Okay. So Skin and Flowers actually began as a watercolor series based on the poetry of Naira Wahid, an African American poet based in America, as well as Lily Jamaluddin, who's a local poet here. And Lily and I are really good friends, and so we would share our work a lot with each other. And so a lot of Lily's and Nayura's work talk about femininity and talk about the body and the experience of the body. And at the time when the watercolor series was developed, it was a time when I wasn't in a very good relationship with my body as well. Okay. And rather than using the art to talk about that, I'd say the experience of pain, I wanted to try to create a utopia instead. Mm-hmm. I wanted to create a world where if people were experiencing the same thing as I was, they could then see what a probable answer could be. And so it's a depiction of men and women in these very soft, soft ways, you know. I would replace all the hair in the body with flowers. This was based on a particular line from Naira's poem, where she would say, I would like to see, I'm paraphrasing, I think, but I'd like to see more boys with flowers coming out of them, you know, and this idea of like battling toxic masculinity in that sense. Because especially for me as a, it's strange that as an Indian girl growing up, I noticed that a lot of my other friends who are Indian, that patriarchy that you grew up with is very strong, you know, sure. and you observe it with the boys, you observe it with the girls, the difference in the way you're raised, mm-hmm. the way you experience relationships, the way you experience your own body is very different. And I noticed that that kind of toxic masculinity is really ingrained in you as a young Indian boy, very strongly. And that was the one thing I really wanted to grab at. And while that was being explored, then of course I got into gender issues, because at the time I was coming to terms with my own sexuality. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to create, again, another utopia for that. And so a sub-series of Skin and Flowers was Bate. And it was a depiction of these men and these women expressing languages of love to each other. And so when I had the opportunity to do a piece for the Sime Darby Arts Fest, I had in mind to actually bring Skin and Flowers to life, since it was so, it's so visually strong, you know. Mm-hmm. What would it look like if we could then bring that kind of language alive and to be embodied? What happens if the people could see what it looks like to be soft and free? And so Skin and Flowers is specifically based on LGBT experiences of myself and my actors and everyone involved. Both we were a mix of both queer and as well as hetero writers.
Okay.
Yeah, and so Lily was one of my writers as well. We came together, we devised the entire show based on the paintings and based on their own reflections of poetry and their own, how they embody the world. Mm-hmm. And with that, we then brought the paintings to life in a 20-minute piece.
Okay, yeah. And I'm guessing your hope was to reach out to a lot of people who are also internally struggling with issues of body image as well, sexuality and all of that as well?
Yes, and mostly what we wanted to do, we wanted to strike this very thin line of, and very tough line of creating a piece that would appeal and resonate with the queer community and not so much with the straight community. Because I found a lot of work that is about queer narratives, mm-hmm. in theatre especially, there is a sense of over-explanation. There's always a needing to explain it. Yes, you know, it's
everything.
I went through this and that is why I am here and that's why you need to listen to me. And I'm just like, okay, that's great. You know, and it's wonderful and I'm sure a lot, and it's important work, yes. But for me at the time, especially like, for example, work like Men in Heels, you know, when I watched it, I was like, okay, yes, this is beautiful, this is great. But I need something for me. Mm-hmm. I need to know what it would mean to survive these things. What's the real experience of it without needing to explain to myself, the same way you could put up a piece about, say, the Indian experience without needing to explain every single cultural reference, right? It's, mm-hmm. just accepted as it is. It's just used as it is.
Sure.
So we wanted to recreate that instead. So nothing was over-explained. Everything was just as it is. The text was just as it is. The paintings were just as they are. And we did that, actually. So it was a piece for the community to say, like, this is how we experience our queerness here. This is how we are trying to redefine the language around our experience. Mm-hmm. We are trying to reclaim this experience of pain, because we all know that being LGBT in this country is painful. That's a given. But we are also people with dimension. We experience joy, we experience love, you know, euphoria. These are things that get buried, really. We become very 2D creatures in the media, and the way people view us. Mm-hmm. And that does affect you as a queer person as well, coming out to see, like, these are the only ways of being, almost. You almost have to be in pain, you know? And I just,
it's almost like typecasting, right?
Yes, it's like typecasting. And I was just like, well, if we could challenge that. If instead a queer kid who's coming out, who is still trying to grapple with their sexuality, sees our show and sees that they could actually just be. There is a need to grapple, per se. There is a need to fight something. You can just exist in a space as you wish to be. Mm-hmm. It's something I wish I knew or I could have had before, you know? So yeah, it was a show for the community, really.
Okay, and how was it, how well received was it? I'm sure it was very well received, but I mean, what sort of reactions did you get that, you know, sort of, I guess, made you feel like, yes, okay, I'm doing the right thing?
Well, we definitely had a lot of queer people come for the show, and they did come up to us and they did send us messages and they said how much they loved it. And of course, given the nature of the show and given at the time that we staged it, because this was about a week after what happened in Georgetown Fest with the portraits.
Sure.
So there was a sense of, for me as a director especially, it was a real sense of safety for my actors and for everyone involved in the show. Because if anyone wanted to come out and attack us, they could. You know, they had ample material. Everyone knew it was a queer show. We marketed it as a queer show. So they had ammunition completely. And, you know, and so, and that's great and all in making statements, but safety is a real thing. And unfortunately, we don't really have proper systems to ensure the safety of people, not even to say the community itself. It's just people who are involved in this kind of work. So we had to kind of dial it back a little bit. We couldn't really get proper reviews of the show. But from what we know, word of mouth and from people who have come up to us, they really did enjoy it. And it's also really pretty, I must say. Yeah. So okay. It's a good show.
All right. And we'll talk a little bit more about, you know, how you're also doing that in your hometown in Port Dickson. I'm speaking today to Ayan Fatin Ismatulain and Veshalini Naidu for our Universal Children's Day special. And we'll continue this discussion after this quick break. You are listening to Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the show today are two young activists, Ayan Fatin Ismatulain and Veshalini Naidu, who are sharing their struggles and how they are working within their communities to counter negative stereotypes. So Ayan, you've also done, you know, all these programs by Joas and, you know, with UNICEF and all of that. So you learned art as well and design. And I understand that part of what you want to do for your community is not just to teach the world, but also Orang Asli children themselves about everything that you've learned. Mm-hmm. How do you hope to do that?
I hope that I can build a community school.
Okay.
Like now we got one community school in Pahang. It's Kuala Lipis. The teachers is from the Orang Aslis. Yeah, they don't have any education also. But they teach the kids using what they know. Like, they teach the kid using the natural way. Yeah. So I hope I can build a community school in Pahang also, in my communities. Yeah.
What would you like people to know about the issues that you face back in your community? I mean, if there's something that you've always wanted to tell, you know, us peninsula folk, us, you know, just living in the city folk, right, who just take for granted or have very, I suppose, negative perceptions perhaps of Orang Asli community. I mean, how would you like to counter all those sorts of narratives that are, you know, built up about your community?
I just want people to know that we exist in Malaysia.
Yes, very.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, because some of my friends, they asking me, where you come from? Oh, I'm from Malaysia. Okay, then, are you Malay? No, I'm not. I'm Orang Asli. What is Orang Asli? Then I tell them.
Right.
But they still do not understand.
They don't understand. Yeah. So meaning they've never been exposed to Orang Asli communities or yeah. anything to do with them. They don't know their traditions. They don't know
yeah,
anything
they
about
don't
them.
Know.
Okay. So when you try to explain it to them, are they open to understanding it? Or do they, I mean, are they receptive to what you tell them?
Some of them, yeah. But some of them say, actually, I don't believe you. I think all the indigenous people from Africa feel like, oh, okay.
What does that even mean?
Yeah, I still don't know what they mean, but okay. I try to explain again mm-hmm. to those who's not really understand, and then I prove it to them by a books. It's right by COAC. It's a Center for Orang Asli Concern.
Sure, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I show their books Red and Raw.
Red and Raw?
Red and Law. Red and Law, like this.
Okay.
Yeah, about the Orang Asli's, about our life, about our right, yeah, our cultures and everything. Mm-hmm. What did we do for our life?
Mm-hmm. Do they understand sort of how that you were here first? You were here first, essentially. I mean, you are the natives of the land. Do they understand those sorts of concepts, or do they think that you are pendatang, as you know, some people like
yeah.
to use? They do think that.
Yeah,
I see. That's very troubling. Mm. Okay, so I guess you are also hoping to try and address these sorts of misconceptions as well, right? As a young person yourself, I think you know social media is something that. I guess our elders didn't quite have to promote these sorts of messages. Are you using social media at all to try and, you know, get that message out and, you know, just change minds, I suppose?
Yeah, I got a Facebook. I publish it in Facebook, but mm-hmm. I got a lot of negative comments, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
I mean, please share. What sort of comments did you get?
The comments, like, it's... The Malay say, Orang Asli is not from Malaysia. Yeah, and then they say many things about us. Yeah, yeah, like not just Orang Asli in Peninsula Malaysia, but Sabah Sarawak also. I don't know. I just say about Orang Asli in Peninsula Malaysia, but I don't know why suddenly they talk like Sabah and Sarawak also. I say it's not included actually. Orang Asli is just in Peninsula Malaysia. Mm-hmm. Sabah and Sarawak is Orang Asal. Mm-hmm. It's a different, yeah, different.
There's a difference there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think, am I wrong in saying that they bring up issues of, for example, land rights and things yeah. like that? I mean, we hear so much about it, especially, you know, the Orang Asli fighting against developers for... Most recently, I heard it was planting durian, mm-hmm. durian king, yeah, Musang king, sorry.
Kelantan, yeah.
Kelantan, right? Yeah, and, yeah. You know, we've seen in Ulu Muda, you know, the different blockades and everything like that. I mean, that is a reality, right, that
yeah.
you struggle
yeah.
with as well.
I go to Kelantan before I follow my parents, mm-hmm. because my parents are also activists.
Okay.
Yeah. So we just go and ask the communities... And then we also go and see the blockade and say, and after we come back from the blockade, we had the Kelantan government come in, and then I don't know what they do. I think they destroyed the house, the blockade.
Right.
Yeah.
Basically used violence?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. When they, I mean, you were there for the blockades, right? Wait, did you kind of see them going to protest, going to the police to make reports and all of that? I mean, were the authorities helpful?
Actually, they got to do the police report, but no use, actually. No use. Yeah, until they bring it to the magistrate.
Mm, the courts? Yeah,
the courts, and they got a letter from the court that say, no one can touch Orang Asli's land.
Mm-hmm.
But then now still going on, yeah.
It's going on, yeah. And I mean, it's not something that's... special to Malaysia. I mean, we see indigenous communities all over the world fighting for their native customary rights for yeah. their land. And it's unfortunate that it's still happening, and it's all in the name of development. I put that in inverted commas. How do you hope that, you know, I mean, we're in Malaysia Baru now, you know, we've got a new government in place and all of that. And there's a lot of hope, I suppose, mm-hmm. you know, everywhere still. How do you hope things will change in this new Malaysia? As a young person yourself.
Yeah, I hope the new government will give us our right, like our youth orang aslis.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, a lot of us graduated from the past universities, the past college, but we not really get the job. Yeah,
you're not taken seriously.
Yeah,
okay.
Because like my brother, he's graduated from engineering school.
Okay.
Yeah, engineering college, but until now he also didn't get any job because he is orang asli. I hope the government can open a chance for us to work like others and never judge our where are we from. Yeah.
Don't judge you just based on where you're from.
Yeah.
Okay. How important is it for you, especially as the younger guys, to keep asking these questions, to keep the fight going, I suppose? And unfortunately, it is a bit of a fight, isn't it?
Because I think with the youth, so we cannot just give it to the to our parents. Like my parents say, if you didn't continue what I do, you will lose what you have now.
Right. So just keep fighting that fight.
Yeah.
Is it important for you as well to identify as an activist? Is that something that you feel strongly about?
Yeah.
Okay. And like you said, you know, you do get, like, for example, on Facebook, you do get negative comments and I suppose a lot of bullying as well to some extent. And
yeah.
How do you deal with that?
I just ignore it, what they say.
Well done.
Yeah.
Because you know they're trolls and you know they're just trying to invade your space with their, I will say, nonsense.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Vesha, back to you. You are also, I would say, identify as an activist.
Yeah.
And why is that important to you to identify as, you know, activist?
I think it's in the treatment of the word itself. It's the way we wrap language around the word activist. Because for me, I mean, technically, it's not particularly important. Okay. I do use it, I come to identify if it's asked only. Because I do think that the work of the activist is already in my practice as a theatre maker, as a illustrator, as a poet. And so in these many fields, I would reply and say, yes, I would say maybe activism is probably the umbrella term for everything else that I do.
Okay.
Yeah. But otherwise, yeah, and I guess if it helps people to then take the work more seriously, then by all means, I'll do it. You know, because in particular, well, for me right now, my headspace, I'm very fascinated by language. I'm very fascinated by how things alter and change just by the use of language alone and how people experience or frame things in their mind. If I did not come in as an activist in, say, putting up Skin and Flowers, if this was just a show, that it would just, I do not think the nuance of what we were trying to say would have come through.
Mm-hmm.
If I had not been known as an activist, if I was just a theatre maker, it would have been a very pretty physical theatre piece.
Sure.
And I think it's in that, even in the poetry, it could just be a poet speaking, or it could be, if I were to come in as an activist, then people then would give, they pay a bit more attention. However, I do think that attention also is very limited to the urban intellectual spheres of the city as well. So there are limitations to the language itself. I'd say that I would use it right now as an experiment, I think, at the moment. Yeah.
Sure.
To see how far this actually takes me. Yeah, because I know that there is this invisible wall when activism that comes, you know. And that wall is usually when it goes to government. You know, where legislation and things, where the real work needs to happen, that's where the power kind of halts,
right?
Really. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when we take this language of activism and we put it into these different spheres that get disseminated much quicker than, say, press releases or research papers in the art, in text. And as it gets into society, then does it travel further? How does it come back then to the government? How does it come through in legislature? Things like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So activist for experiment. Yeah.
Activist for experiment. Okay, but I imagine that naysayers, shall we call them, would say that you are merely acting out in self-interest. Mm. That you're not actually seeing the value or potential of, you know, humanity in all its forms. It's just. I mean, driven by self, self-interest. How would you respond to that?
Mm.
I'd say ain't no shame in that.
Yeah, true too. See, the funny thing about that is that everyone acts out of self-interest. I think people do not give power to experiences. I think that's the issue here. Because experiences are almost always shared to a certain degree. So whatever work you do make based on your experiences that you're acting out of, as much as, say, it could be, and this is a bit of the harsh truth, the majority of society can disagree with you, there will always be a group of people who will resonate very dearly. And that is your power, you know, and we're all very capable of this kind of power. And it's recognizing within your own capacity what that language looks like, this language of power. Mm-hmm. My language of power is in art. And unfortunately, in my early stages, that language is very much rooted in my experiences first. But what is beautiful about the work of art, especially in theatre, in the kind of theatre I practice, which is device, is that it needs to include the other people in the room. It needs to include the other experiences. It's finding then the commonality in it, the common language to then break that apart, recreate a brand new language that could then include everything else. And you would find with any work that you do, even if you... if it were even in radio, right, in the way that you would ask these questions, edit the final podcast in a way that would speak to different aspects of society, it's self-interest in you wanting to explore this topic, but because it is inherently the work of the public, that it still will stray away. No matter what, it will stray away from that. A person calling me out and saying that I am working out of self-interest is reflecting on their experiences of my work, which is based on their self alone. Mm-hmm. But there will be other people who would agree with this person as well. Mm-hmm. So as much as we like to try to run away, everything we do is still connected to a community. It's still community.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, my argument is always that, you know, you of course you draw from personal experience to speak up about injustice. I mean, you obviously speak up about injustice because you have faced it in your own life. And same with you, Vesha, you know, you're using that. Of course, it comes from a personal place.
Mm.
It's important to step up. And I think, you know, we're seeing it globally as well. You know, the younger groups, the younger generation are stepping up. We saw it in America with the issues of gun control, for example, you know, the way they rallied and, you know, started all those movements. What does stepping up mean to you, Ayin? You know, how do you, as a young member of the Orang Asli community, how do you see yourself stepping up, you know, taking that message out, you know, dispelling all those misconceptions that, you know, you are from Africa or, you know, there's no such thing as Orang Asli, you are pendatang. How do you hope to step up and change that narrative?
I hope that the government will change the dan lain-lain word. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because when I go for the interviews, the person who interviews me will ask me, are you Malay, Chinese, Indian, or lain-lain? Then I say, I'm not lain-lain, I'm Orang Asli. Yeah. They say, but not inside the paper. But yeah, now, not now, before also, they will write it as lain-lain. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but when I was, I think, primary school, the dan lain-lain, the one I changed to Orang Aslis.
Mm-hmm.
Peninsula Malaysia, what is my risk? Yeah.
Well done. Standing up from a young age. Well done, Ayin. And I'm sure people didn't like that. People didn't like that they couldn't box you in a certain identity. So I guess your hope is that we are just called Malaysians. There's no need to have race-based... Okay. And Visha, how about you? What does stepping up mean to you? And, you know, how do you hope fellow young people will step up?
Yeah, I'd say, like, my concern right now is turning our lens inward into our specific communities now,
sure,
into your current reality and what you're going through. If you are experiencing abuse, if you're in a very abusive home, or you're experiencing a kind of bullying in schools, within these considerably smaller cases, you would say, my idea of stepping up is, what would you do to honor yourself in these situations first? Mm-hmm. Because it's very difficult to act on a larger scale when you do not have that internally already. It's that ability to articulate yourself within these smaller circles first, because it gets harder and harder as you try to fight it, and becomes bigger and bigger, the mm-hmm. issue. Mm-hmm. So to me, for example, a boy, I did this choral speaking training for a school in Port Dickson, and these kids are beautiful. Like, they're so great. I mean, they're 13 or 15 years old, you know. And I remember, Form 1 or Form 3, gender politics was very strong already. You already knew who you were, who you were supposed to be as a girl, and boys, and how they're supposed to be as boys.
Sure.
It was really surprising to come to the school and I see these kids, and they are mixing with each other so well. You know, that sense of girls in one side, boys in the other, or this is a men's world, a boys' world, and girls aren't really allowed into it, wasn't there. And these boys were, you know, freely talking to the girls. They were very affectionate with the girls as well. They had no issue holding their hands in or even hugging them and things like that. And the girls reciprocated as well. There was just this sense of real care in a very equal way. And I was observing this outside the classroom. But the moment I walked in, that changed immediately. And I think that because internally these children do not believe nor practice the idea of gender politics, but they feel that it has to be performed when they are witnessed by someone on the outside who does not understand the world or is new to the world. So I think when they saw me, immediately the boys kind of they pulled away and they became all very tough, and you know, it was funny. And there was this one boy who did not understand what was happening. So he was looking at his friends and he's seeing them suddenly stiffen up and just be and start acting rough. And they were pulling away from the girls. And this boy, you could just see him in the middle, and he's just looking at his friends, and he's looking at the girls, and he was holding a girl's hand, and then a boy, one of his friends, just pushed him on the shoulder and said, "Let go. What are you doing?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you see him just struggle for a moment, you know, and I think about that situation. I think standing up is really as simple as letting these kids be.
Mm-hmm.
Without having the language of the outside world that we have, you know, made into this really monstrous thing, come into them. It's as basic as that. And what I loved about theatre is that it really does break these things down. Mm-hmm. So after a couple of theatre games, getting them to move their bodies and stuff, that was completely gone. And they were back to their happy selves, you know, and they were mixing freely, and they were soft.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen boys as soft as that before. So they exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happens when you give these kids that kind of language? It is as simple as getting them to be comfortable in their body. Standing up is to not feel insecure about showing affection to another boy. Standing up is standing up for a girl who gets rape jokes thrown at her in class. They are very small things. But because when you grow up in that practice, and you're raised with that experience, that when you come out into the bigger world, the big city, and the politics of the big city, that you are able to kind of, that internal work does not need to be done. Mm-hmm. You already have it in you. You already have a very strong language in you that you can then articulate your solutions to the city, I think.
All right. And I'm afraid we're running out of time, but I mean, you know, it is Universal Children's Day. What would your message be for this year? What would your message be to anyone listening?
I hope that Malaysian or not Malaysian will recognize us as a Malaysian. And I hope we can stand together to protect our right. Yeah, I hope the orang asli also can stand together, protect their right. Yeah.
Okay. And what about you, Visha?
Okay, I'd say for the kids, take a moment on this day to just sit with yourself first. Sit with yourself and I think ask a very key question. How are you feeling? Whatever emotion that is, I think they owe it to themselves to explore it fully. And I think this, if this was a constant practice of self-care, really putting the work into addressing how you're feeling, and then try to troubleshoot, perhaps with people you trust. It might not need to be your family. In a lot of cases, families aren't necessarily safe spaces.
Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately. It could be a teacher, perhaps, or a friend as well. Troubleshoot methods to then explore this. It could be in your art. It could be in writing, you know, things like that. For the adults in the room, actually sit with your kid and ask them that same question and try to make that spaces. We also live in an age of technology and the internet. We can find multiple ways to have civil and heartful conversations. That is really missing here. Nothing can be done if you don't know what's happening, mm-hmm. if you don't know what the problem is specifically. And these problems are really internalized and they're grounded into their base. And when you come out as an adult, because it's so far down, you don't even recognize it anymore. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest to everyone, to anyone you know, even one adult to the other, ask them how you're feeling. Because everyone has an inner child as well. An inner child who has gone through similar things. What has happened to that kid too in you? Yeah, I'd say that.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today. I've been speaking to Ayan Fatin Ismatulayan and Veshalini Naidu, who joined me today in conjunction with Universal Children's Day, sharing their stories of how they're trying to make a difference in their communities and in their own way. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Feminist Fridays interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play and the App Store. And we're also available on Spotify now. Just search under the podcast section and you'll find us there. This has been Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.